Bucks Pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show at FM Talk 106.5. Happy Tuesday morning to you. Still to come on the program today, we'll be joined by State Representative Shane Stringer. That's at the bottom of the hour. So please, if you would, stay tuned for that. But joining us now on the line, he represents Alabama's 3rd Congressional District. Always a pleasure to have him on. Congressman Michael Rogers joins us. Congressman, how are you this morning?
Doing wonderfully. Hope you are too.
Doing well. Doing well. Let's get right into it. First up, COVID-19 response, it looks like the window was missed there, and the president went at it on his own with some executive orders. Just your thoughts on how all of that has played out so far.
Well, pretty predictably, I never believed that the Democrats seriously wanted to get a deal. They think this plays to their political benefit to have chaos and disruption. So I think the president did what he thought he had to do. I think it turned out to be a good political move. They did not expect it. And we'll see what they do next.
Yeah, and there's some talk that they might try to challenge it in the courts or something of that nature. But politically, if they did that, they would be seen as, you know, not wanting people to get the benefits they very well may need or things of that nature. So in some ways, the gesture from the president tactically was it seemed to be like a good political move.
It does. I'm very impressed with his political acumen in this situation, and I'm not sure of his legal standing to do it, but at least he has a colorable argument that he has the legal standing to do it based on the Supreme Court decision last year that allowed him to move DOD money to build the fence along the southern border. So as a member of the legislative branch, I don't like these executive orders that I believe usurp congressional authority. So I think that he's on challengeable grounds, but at least he has a good argument that he has the legal authority to do it based on that decision last year.
Is the door closed on that? Do you think it's just too close to the election to get any movement? Are you optimistic? Do you think something will happen in Congress?
I'm not optimistic on getting a deal on a CARES Act 4, if that's what you're making reference to.
Right, yeah. The Democrats just don't want to be seen, I guess, giving Donald Trump a victory, and that's the fear that might be the consequence.
Well, the despicable thing about what's happening is they're more concerned about beating him in November than helping the American people through this pandemic that's just been such a devastating, has such a devastating effect on America and the world. And Donald Trump did not create the pandemic, but they want to beat him so bad, they don't mind letting people suffer and worry over the next few months rather than us trying to help them get back to some sense of normalcy. And it's not just this deal. You know, Jeff, I got a copy of our new schedule. The majority leader, Steny Hoyer, put out the schedule for the rest of the year, and they only have us going back into session in mid-September for 3 weeks and then back out. So for the next 12 weeks, the House of Representatives will only make for three. We have a world of work that we need to be doing, and instead, they won't even call us back into town because they don't want any sense of normalcy to return to the American government or the American population until after the election, because they believe it helps them beat Donald Trump. And I think it's going to backfire on them.
Yeah, because then you get the do-nothing Congress, but we know who, when you look at it, the face of that's obviously going to be Nancy Pelosi, right?
That's exactly it. I mean, I think that this is going to backfire. People understand not showing up for work, particularly when the Senate's been back full-time for months now. The executive branch has been working full-time. We expect Walmart workers and pharmacy workers and others that manufacturers to be considered essential. But yet the U.S. House of Representatives is not essential. It's indefensible.
Yeah, and I think perhaps the public will take notice of it. Something else I want to talk about. You are the ranking member on the Homeland Security Committee. The stuff we're seeing in these cities and the Department of Homeland Security having to get involved in some of these circumstances, particularly what's going on in Portland, but all this civil unrest There's a lot of people on edge. What are your thoughts about the federal government's role in what we're seeing?
Well, with regard to Portland in particular, you know, that the problem that we've got there is that we have a federal courthouse that these rioters, and these aren't protesters, these are rioters, have openly said they intend to burn down. And they brought the equipment to do it every night. They come out after midnight and stay out until about 4 or 5 a.m. trying to destroy that building. Now, every federal courthouse in America has federal protective services there as security. You know, we've got my office in Anniston is in a courthouse. My office in Opelika is in a federal courthouse. Both have armed guards there that are security, and those people work for the Federal Protective Service. They are also in the Portland courthouse, and they've been there for decades like every other courthouse in America. Well, once the protesters and the rioters started trying to destroy the building, we had to up those numbers of security personnel because the mayor and the city council forbade the police department from protecting that federal building. So we've had to send more people in as a consequence of that. So this is not like we're moving troops in, military troops in. We're moving people whose job it is to protect the building in, to protect the building. And we're going to do it as long as that's the federal courthouse, whether they like it or not.
Well, beyond just federal property even, beyond the federal courthouses being threatened, does the federal government have a role in these cities maybe not acting as they should in these circumstances?
Well, I think only after the governor of each state, you know, that they have primary responsibility for peace and tranquility in their state. And if the local government's not going to secure the communities, then I think first responsibility goes to the governor to move in state police and or the guard. And then if a governor won't do it, I think that the president within his right to protect and secure the safety of the people in this country. But it's only after the governor of a state refuses to do it. And I find it hard to believe many governors are going to politically refuse to protect the safety of their citizens in any city. But then there's a couple of nutty governors out there. You know, you go over into Oregon and, you know, that's a prime example of one. And you go to Washington State, there's another one that's he's about goofy too.
We're joined by Congressman Mike Rogers from Alabama's 3rd Congressional District here on the program. Congressman, big economic engine in your district is college football with Auburn University. The discussion about not having the season or whether or not to have the season. Nick Saban, coach of Alabama Crimson Tide, comes out yesterday, says, yeah, we should go forward with college football. Well, what are your thoughts on college football being played in 2020?
I think we need to get back to regular order. I think that schools need to reopen. It's in the kids' best interest, health-wise, as not only education, but health-wise, be back in school. I think the universities need to be back in school. I think that kids are worried they can do the virtual option. Every school is offering hybrid classes. But I think football season needs to go on. It's like Coach Saban said, they've had a 2% infection rate, which is far below the general population. And these kids are much more apt to get the infection out hanging around with their friends and other people than they are on the football field, where they're taking great precautions to keep everything disinfected and safe. So, and then it's just, again, it's part of getting back to normalcy. Our country needs to see that, and I'm all for it. I don't care what the MAC conference does or some other goofy conference. I think that the SEC needs to play football.
Is it the fear of this, though, that there's a liability element that if somebody gets sick, the litigious nature of society right now might go after the school? Is that something they need to be worried about?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm a recovering attorney, as you know, and it would be really hard to convince a jury to convict a school of negligence for having a football program, because you're not compelling a kid to play. You know, these kids have all been told if they don't want to play, they can keep their scholarship. These kids want to play more than then we want to see them play. And they live for this stuff. So it'd just be really hard in the middle of a global pandemic to assign responsibility and liability to a school for having class or having football or whatever. Just like I think it would be hard to assign responsibility to an employer if somebody gets infected at work. I mean, gets infected because you can't prove that the infection happened at the plant. You know, one of the things I've heard from some of my manufacturers is they've had employees get infected, but they got infected because they went to a family gathering or went out to have a barbecue with some friends, and that's where they contracted it, and then they came to work thereafter. So you can't really, I don't think there's a big issue with liability. I hate that Democrats are refusing for us to statutorily give liability protections to employers, but, you know, they're owned by the trial lawyers. So that is what it is.
I mean, that's such a big part of it, it seems, is that getting that liability immunity. We've talked about it a lot. It seems like two components of this would be a vaccine and then some kind of liability protection that then you're really cooking with gas as far as getting back to normal.
Absolutely. And that's, again, they don't want to get back to normal. All they care about with complete focus is beating Donald Trump in November, and they're not going to do it. You know, one of the things that I saw on the news last night, which I thought was a great reminder of how well I think the president's going to do, is they had a poll released from Florida that showed that at this point before the 2016 election, Hillary Clinton was beating Donald Trump by 9 points in Florida. Right now, Biden's leading him by 4 points. And I don't believe he's leading him at all. I think the polls were wrong in 2016. I think they're wrong now. But even their polls are showing that it's closer. The American people are not taking this well, what the Democrats are doing, and I think they're going to punish them in November at the polls because they have been irresponsible. I don't know if you saw the news that just came out where the ACLU is calling for Department of Homeland Security to be disbanded. It's all part of this defund the police thing. They're mad because we're protecting the border. They're mad because the DHS is protecting federal courthouses. They're mad because DHS is finding illegal aliens here and removing us the country. And the Democrats and the liberals do not want us to have police and the rule of law in this country enforced. And I think they're going to pay for that in November.
Yeah, it seems that you have a whole set, a new slew of priorities for voters out of the pandemic and out of the civil unrest. But looking into your crystal ball for 2020, for November 3rd, particularly Capitol Hill, getting the House back, Donald Trump may have coattails. How are you feeling? How are your colleagues feeling about those prospects?
Well, we're gonna whether we get the House back or not is going to depend on how well the president does. The fact is that 37 of the seats that we lost in 2018 were seats that he carried in the last election, but he wasn't on the ballot in 2018. And there's a huge contingent of voters that will turn out for him, but they're not turning out otherwise. So if he does well, I think we get, you know, we're 17 seats away from having the majority back in the House. If he has a good night, we're going to get the majority back. If he loses, we will not get the majority back. Or if he squeaks by, it'll be we'll pick up seats, but I don't know if we'll get the majority. I don't believe we're going to lose the Senate. I believe that we're going to be okay on the Senate. But the House is going to be depending on how well the president does. And as you've heard me say in my earlier comments, I think the president's going to do real well, and I think we retake the House.
I mean, it just seems as Democrats are trying to make this election about a referendum on Trump and less about the merits of their candidate, who is not really out as much in public as you would expect a presidential nominee of a major American political party to be.
Yeah, and nobody's excited about Joe. I mean, I like Joe Biden personally, but, you know, the president is not exaggerating when he says he's lost his fastball. I mean, the Joe Biden that's on the stump now is not nearly as in command of the subject matter he's talking about in his delivery as he has been in years past. And it's going to happen to all of us one day. We're all going to get old and we're going to lose our cognitive capabilities. And that's what's happened with him. And that's why they're keeping him out of the spotlight, because he was prone to gaffes even when he was a young man. But, man, he's really a train wreck now.
Hey, Congressman, we got to leave it there. We're out of time, but as always, I really appreciate you making time to come on radio today.
Glad to. Thank you.
All right, that was Congressman Mike Rogers, Alabama's 3rd Congressional District. We got to take another break. We will return. This is the Jeff Porch Show on FM Talk 106.5.
Waking and baking every morning at 8. Make it to work, they're always late. Living by the job, paying their dues. Life in Dixie with these Alabama blues. Cotton on the roadside, cotton in the ditch. We all picked the cotton, but we never got rich. Daddy was a veteran, a Southern Democrat. They ought to get a rich man to vote like that. Sing it. Song, song of the South. Sweet potato pie and I shut my mouth. Gone, gone with the wind. There ain't nobody looking back again.
Welcome back to the Jeff Porch Show at FM Talk 106.5. Coming up in the next segment, my good friend Shane Stringer, state representative, he joins us. Make sure that you stay tuned for that. Big show planned for you tomorrow. We'll kick off with Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall will be with us. We'll also have Dave Baker, the mayor of Sims, Alabama. Jerry Carl, the Republican nominee for Congress in Alabama's 1st Congressional District, and as we are going to do every Wednesday, we'll have from Yellowhammer News, Sean Ross joining us. So a lot of reasons for you to tune in tomorrow. A pretty stacked lineup of guests. We'll get their thoughts on everything going on from elections to college football and the sort. A couple of recap, a few things talked about on the program so far. I think if you're watching the news and you see what's going on in Chicago, you see what's going on in Seattle with the defunding of the police department, you see all these things going on in these big American cities. Are you thinking twice about living in the city now? Not so much that you don't think it could happen here, but rioting and looting, say you're near an area of commerce, a high-traffic area where there's lots of activity, do you want to be around that, knowing this could happen in your neck of the woods? And then my whole contention is it's that perception that's going to do damage to this sort of revival of city living, that it's living in the city is kind of a cool thing to do. You see what's happening in the Georgetown neighborhood, Washington, D.C. You see what's happening on Manhattan's Upper West Side. You look at these, the Magnificent Mile in Chicago is the one that's getting a lot of attention right now. I think it's going to change things. I think you're going to see demographics. People are going to move to the suburbs. People don't want to live in the city. Yeah, in the cases of a lot of these major American cities, the governing class is just a basket case. You don't know what to expect. And if you're going to spend $500,000, $1 million on a townhouse somewhere, because real estate in those cities are high. I mean, It is just something you got to be concerned with. I'm going to make this investment in property, and do I want to take that chance? Do I want to put my money here and then have it susceptible to certain things? So I think you're going to see people move back to the suburbs. And I think that's a very it's going to be intriguing to see how this plays out in the long run. If this goes beyond the November election, very well may see it. But if these mayors, it would behoove them politically to get things in control to make this, no, this is a safe place for you to live, for you to kick your kids to the park. Right now, though, no one wants to deal with that. No one wants to deal with that, and I think it's going to change a lot of things. Obviously, the other big story today, college football, will it happen, not happen in a lot of places. It's not going to happen. Big Ten, Pac-10, not going to happen. A couple of schools would prefer it to happen, but it was funny. They had a vote yesterday, and I think by a margin of like 12-2, right? Iowa and Nebraska wanted to keep college football. The rest of the Big Ten schools, no. We're still waiting to see what the ACC is going to do. But what people really want to see is what is that SEC going to do? That is kind of that's where things happen. That's where things move. Because I'll tell you what, guys, if the SEC early on had said we're not doing football next year, then all these other conferences would have followed suit automatically. The Pac-10 does it? Not so much. There's still hope. There's still the prospect. Big 10, Big 12, you name it, ACC. But with the SEC is the big shoe to drop. So really, that the future of college football for 2020, I would argue, relies more on the SEC than anywhere else. All right, folks, we got to take a break. We will return. This is the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5.
Hello, West Virginia coal miner. Let me thank you for your time. You work a 40-hour week for a living. Just to send it on down the line. This is for the one who drives the big rig.
And welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. Big day for you tomorrow. One more time, we'll be joined by Attorney General Steve Marshall, also Mayor Sims Dave Baker, Republican nominee for Congress in the 1st Congressional District, Jerry Carl, and Sean Ross of Yellowhammer News. So please, if you would, tune in for that. But joining us now, a friend of the show, or a friend of my show up in Huntsville, we'll make him a friend of the show here as well. State Representative Shane Stringer joins us in studio. Representative, how are you this morning?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for coming in. Let's get right into it. First off, District COVID-19, all these unusual circumstances and events going on in our lives. How is that going for your folks?
It's definitely a challenge. It's a new world we're living in, and everybody's adjusting daily and, you know, hopefully getting reacquainted and getting situated to handle all the new changes that we have facing us.
Yeah, and it seems like there's an adjustment period, but as far as I can tell, people are kind of going along and getting along with it. I guess the question is, then what? Like, where we know we're going along to get along, but where are we headed? And that's the big question.
Yeah, and I hope that hopefully things will get back to somewhat of a normal for everyone. But, you know, I guess maybe we are going to have to face a new normal with some of the safety precautions that we're taking now. And, you know, I think once the peak of the COVID hits, you know, I think it's going to start to go down, and I think you're going to see things go back to somewhat of a normal.
Yeah, I think people are kind of adjusted to it. Maybe we've already seen that peak. Maybe we are heading in that other direction. But until we get that vaccination, then things are never going to be fully normal, or as normal as we would like them to be.
That's correct. You know, and it's just, we're just going to have to meet it head on and just take things one day at a time and try to live our lives as normal as we can, and try to, you know, make sure that we're adjusting and just being careful.
Well, and you know, you with your background in law enforcement and understanding that aspect of it, I had Hoss Mack on in the last hour, but those challenges that's gotta present some unusual challenges for law enforcement and maintaining law and order. I mean, you see what's going on all around the country right now, but here in Alabama, in the back of your mind, knowing there seems like just in the span of, let's say, the difference between what we were doing in 2019 on this day versus now, there seems to be a whole longer list of things you've got to be aware of if you are in a police department or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's God, it's some challenging times for our law enforcement profession. You know, not only are they having to be vigilant of the COVID and you know, not only for their safety, but the safety of the people that they have to arrest or come in contact with, but they're also having to deal with all the uncertainties that with the unrest that's going on across this country. I mean, yeah. We have law enforcement officers getting shot and killed for no reason, and we've even had it here in Alabama. You know, it's scary. I have a son that's a law enforcement officer, and it scares me, you know, that someone could just go up and kill him for no reason.
Yeah, and we, especially in Alabama, had last year, before we're talking about any of these new issues, there was a kind of a weird phenomenon with these law enforcement officials killed in the line of duty. And you kind of wonder, well, it keeps happening, is there a policy solution, or were we just in difficult times?
You know, it's always challenging, and this ain't just started. This has been going on for centuries, and dealing with the relationship of law enforcement and the public. You know, we have to constantly, you know, ultimately, as a administrator in law enforcement for years, all I ask of my employees is to treat people the way they wanted to be treated. And if we do that, you can't go wrong. You know, law enforcement executives, if they will, you know, do what they're doing, which is police ourselves, and let's try to eliminate problems and deal with the issues at hand, we're gonna stay in front of this. And our area has been extremely blessed with good administrators that do that.
Yeah, you know, and avoiding the worst of these scenarios, it seems, been either very, very fortunate, but there's also that, I guess, an element of the professional training, the police academies. Do you think the way we're talking nationally, we always talk about these issues as a, you know, the federal one-size-fits-all approach, but is there more to be done to better equip some of the local law enforcement with some better skills or things like that, you think?
Yeah, we're working on that. You know, law enforcement is constantly evolving. They're constantly reevaluating things, trying to do better in situations such as body cameras, car cameras, and that type situation. The training issues, we're always looking at new and better way of training, and sometimes we have to train we have to change our way of thinking. You know, you have to think outside the box on some of this stuff to address it. You know, of course, we're having to talk more about diversity training and make sure that we have a lot more of the departments that are looking at checks and balances, which is, you know, having some systems in place to hopefully catch problematic employees so we don't have these problems. But, you know, and at the end of the day, you're dealing with human nature. You're going to have some issues from time to time.
It's interesting that you talk about, you know, kind of what's going on with law enforcement, but there's the other side of that. What's going on in society that's leading us to this point where we need more, you know, the law enforcement? You have these, you know, every time we have a mass shooting, we go right into the discussion about mental health. And then I know that you guys did some work on mental health in this last session.
Mm-hmm.
That sometimes some of those components to dealing with the root problem gets lost right now. But do you think we're going to see strides made in that area with the mental health component?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's getting better every day. Of course, you know, every legislation, you know, tenure, they have their set of problems, and years ago there was evidently some issues that caused the mental health to be defunded and put away, and we're seeing the consequences of that over the years. Some of the stuff that we've done in this past legislative session, which is, you know, trying to build more mental health facilities, get more funding there, is going to help these problems. You know, it's just going to have to, it's going to take a little while before it starts to show the fruits of its labor.
Well, let's transition to that. The big topic, prison reform,
mm-hmm.
getting the prison situation under control, an extension of law enforcement, I would argue. There's always been this notion that Republicans are anti-prison. They just assume, you know, no money spent on prisons. We need to spend that money elsewhere. But if it seems like if you really are a law and order Republican, then it would behoove you to be, you know, wanting to fix the problem with the Department of Corrections in Alabama's prisons, that it's not taboo as a Republican member of the legislature to say, hey, we need to do something about this. Does it seem like there's kind of a change there, that the Department of Justice's act,
yeah,
and now the ball's maybe in the state's court?
Yeah, I think it's a prime example of pay me now, pay me later. You know, we've neglected the prisons over the years for so long, and to the point that now, you know, we're fisting out to pay the consequences. But, you know, we have definitely got to get the prisons in a better working order and safer conditions for our correction officers. That it is unacceptable that our correction officers are in the conditions they're in. And, you know, at the end of the day, we're responsible for the welfare of the inmates and the prisoners, and we've got to make sure that we're doing our job there.
Is it just as simple as building new prisons, but are there's going to have to be a lot more done, right?
Yeah, this is going to be a long-term fix here to working on this. We've got to, you know, we've got a lot of issues. We've got employment shortages. You know, just like everyone else in law enforcement, you know, we approved for them to hire 500 correction officers last year, and the last I heard that was they had hired less than 50. You know, that's terrible.
It's tough to get these guys to go work for two reasons. A lot of these prisons are in kind of remote places, so
they
don't have a big labor pool to begin with.
Yep.
But it's just not a job that, you know, who wants to be a prison guard when you have these middle ages diseases going on and things. It's a threat to, it's a hazard, it's a safety hazard for you to take this job. So, like, how much is enough? What's your price to be a prison guard? And I, you know, that's got to seem like it's astronomical.
Yeah, we've got to do some work to try to make this job appeasing to some people. You know, we've got to do more than what we're doing. And it ain't always just about money. It is about the safety, and it is about the appreciation and taking care of your employees. The prisons are, you know, it's gonna take a lot to fix this. This ain't just a money issue.
Yeah, and it's getting to that point where finding the right plan, I think it may in some ways be easier to find the money than to find a plan everybody can agree on. You know, do you get that sense from your colleagues?
Oh, yeah. That's definitely the issue. You know, the money is not as much the issue as it is.
It's not even ideological. Mm-hmm. It's geographic in some ways, seem to be some of the divisions.
It is. And you think about this. Our state, the state of Alabama, is extremely blessed with a lot of great high-paying companies here, especially the Mobile County area with Austal, Airbus, Walmart Shipping Center, all of these steel mills, everything that we have going on. Well, they pull so many employees because of the money that it makes it extremely difficult for law enforcement and our prison systems to recruit and hire people.
Yeah, and that leads me to my next question. The Governor Ivey appears to be working on a plan. The details not yet known. They could be coming at any time. It's August or September. But what's your feeling on the governor going at it on her own to build new prisons? I know you're kind of new to the legislature, but before that, it's always been a hurdle that could never be overcome. But now we have a solution. It seems that the governor can use executive authority to build these on her own.
Well, I mean, she has a lot on her shoulders, and she's having to make some tough decisions. But I do have a problem, and I'm kind of concerned about the private partnerships that we're looking at doing and building these prisons. You know, I think you're opening up the door to allow these companies to charge the state whatever at any point, you know, and I think we really need to look at that. I mean, I think with our economy, even in this pandemic, we're still surviving, and we're still doing okay. The SSUT tax has kind of helped float us and keeping us afloat. But I think we need to be looking at other financial avenues to deal with this other than the private partnerships.
Yeah, well, you know, why couldn't the legislature just, why couldn't it be bonded out to borrow the money? And it seems like you would save the taxpayers a lot more money if the legislature just took a stab at it. But they're not even, you talk to leadership, they seem to be, you know, this is the best path forward. It's the fastest. It's the best way to get the Department of Justice kind of off our back.
Well, I don't think we should rush through this, you know, regardless of whatever the situation. You know, we've got to address the problems, and I think we've got a lot of qualified people. You have more legislators with law enforcement background than you've ever had that are asking the right questions, that are asking the questions that need to be asked in addressing and dealing some of these problems.
I mean, they understand the prison issue is more than just a law enforcement, I mean, more than just an economic issue. When was it, George Wallace, the last time Department of Justice came in, and George Wallace was governor, and he turned Alabama's Department of Corrections into this jobs program, built all these prisons around the state to spark economic activity, which worked kind of okay for a while. But now you got to get back to what the intended purpose is for these correctional institutions, and it's to correct. We've lost that along the way. Is there any hope that it, the way things are going, that, that the mission is back to what it ought to be.
That's something that's got to be addressed. You know, we've just got to, the director's got to look at some of those issues, and some of them have got to be brought to his attention through the legislation or the leadership or the government, you know, or the governor, in trying to address some of these problems. If not, then we're going to keep doing the same thing that we're doing, and that's obviously not working.
Yeah, so this will be something you guys will have to talk about. It doesn't appear to me that there will be a special session, that you're going to have to wait till the next general session in 2021. Do you think that's going to be okay? Do you think that, given that gap and you guys not meeting in Montgomery and the abbreviated session this year, that you're going to, it can wait, it can be kicked down the road at least until next year?
I don't think so. You know, I think we need to have a special session to address some of these issues, and especially the prisons, and, you know, give the legislators a say-so in this. You know, we represent the people of our districts throughout the state, and, you know, the people want to have some kind of a say-so in this. You know, it's going to be sad if we get into a private partnership that really takes a lot of the taxpayer money, you know, not just my generation, but for generations to come. You know, and who's to say that this won't continue? We won't be renting these facilities forever.
Right. Well, and I think you echo the concerns of a lot of your colleagues. We're going to take a quick break. We'll get back into some things once we get on the other side of the break, dealing with COVID-19. This is the Jeff Porch Show at FM Talk 106.5.
On the drum, they stepped so high and they made the bugles ring. We stood beside our cotton bales and didn't say a thing. We fired our guns and the British kept a clean. Hear Richard Best picking on that red guitar. So gather round, now gather round, chill and be down. Well, just get down, chill and get loud. Well, you can be loud, yeah, and be proud. And you can be proud, yeah, and I'll be proud. You will, because South's gonna do it again and again.
Hey, welcome back to the Jeff Porch Show on FM Talk 106.5. Happy Tuesday morning to you. Coming up tomorrow on the program, Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall will be with us. We'll also have Sims Mayor Dave Baker. Jerry Carl, the Republican nominee for Congress here in the 1st Congressional District, and from Yellowhammer News, Sean Ross. A lot of reasons for you to tune in tomorrow. But still with us in studio, we're very grateful for that. State Representative Shane Stringer sitting here. Representative, something I neglected to mention. We were talking about, you passed a gas tax back in the very first part of the quadrennium. We start to see some road projects underway here, particularly in your district. You got two major thoroughfares with 45 and 98, looking at improvements to those. Are you starting to see some of those orange barrels up and some progress being made?
Not really in our district yet. I have been meeting with Director Cooper pretty regular, and we're working on, you know, trying to finish up the 158 project there in Sims. And, of course, we're shooting and politicking hard to try to get something done with Highway 98, finish the four-lane on it, and then, of course, the big project's going to be four-lane and Highway 45 from the Mississippi line, which is up in Representative Easterbrook's district, all the way down to Pritchard through my district.
That 45 has been something talked about since I was a child, of getting it four-lane. It's four-lane to the Mississippi line in Mississippi. It's just when you cross that, it's just narrows, and you hear people talking about it. Is there any sense? Is it just been that it's just a part of the state that the ALDOT has never really given second much thought to? It seems like an afterthought. I mean, really, what has been the hurdle there in getting that done?
I don't know. It's, you know, of course, I have my opinions, you know. I think it's kind of been neglected, but, you know, I don't know if we're pushing hard enough for it. I'm constantly in Director Cooper's ear now, and when I first started meeting with him, he, you know, let me know that there was approximately 30 roads throughout the state in a similar condition and similar traffic, and at that time, you know, he told me we were probably about 18th to 20th in line for that, you know. So I've constantly updated him on stuff, and then of course over time, the last time I met with him, he told me that we were probably fifth or sixth in line. So
well, I just to hear him say 18th or 19th, I mean, 45 is not a new road. It's been this way for a very, very long time, and to be neglected the way it is, it is 18th, 19th on that list for a reason. That it is, it may just be a product of state politics that anything south of Monroe County or whatever is just an afterthought to a lot of these guys.
That's sure the way it feels. I'm watching my colleagues across the state posting stuff on social media about road projects from the infrastructure tax, the gas tax, in their districts, and we're not able to post none of that.
And you voted for the gas tax.
I did.
You supported the Rebuild Alabama Act. These guys that voted against it, maybe you could see that they're not getting those projects, but you voted for it.
Yeah, we're going to keep fighting, and matter of fact, I'll be meeting with Cooper again next week or two, and we're just going to keep fighting until we get it done.
Well, best of luck to you. The music's playing, so that means we got to call it a day, but thanks for coming in.
Yes, sir. Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
That was State Representative Shane Stringer. This has been the Jeff Porsche Show on FM Talk 106.5.